Our next speaker is Dr. Robert Fitzgibbons, the professor of surgery at Creighton University, and he'll be talking about treatment of giant ventral and incisional hernias. Dr. Fitzgibbons.
Thanks again for the privilege of the floor. I alluded a little bit to this morning at the panel discussion about some of the differences between what we do for more conventional abdominal reconstruction compared to the trauma things we saw earlier. So I think even though there'll be some overlap in this talk, I think you'll find it worthwhile. Now, this is not advancing. Sorry about that. That's too bad. You might have just, there it goes. Okay, hope it'll keep working. These are my faculty disclosures. I've showed these before. There's really no significant conflicts of interest here. So what is a giant ventral hernia? There really is no consistent definition. This is the hernia classification system from the European Hernia Society, but it really doesn't really help us at all with our evaluation of patients with giant ventral hernias because they just don't fit into any of these boxes. So really volume considerations are more important, and there's been various strategies to try to compare various giant hernias or huge hernias using CT and trying to measure various parameters. It's not a very exact science yet. Here's a paper that uses a special type of software to outline the volume of the hernia itself versus the intra-abdominal volume, and then using this Mirion Expert software, a ratio can be calculated between the size of the hernia and the total peritoneal surface involved, and if a ratio is greater than 20%, that spells trouble. So here's an example of this. This is a patient with, you can see how the hernia sac itself has been subtracted to allow for a CC estimation of the size of the hernia, and then the ratio in this patient was 22%. This is, as I say, is an inexact science, but it is something that we needed to be able to get a clearer idea of, and that's because it's very unpredictable who is going to have a lot of trouble with these hernia repairs, who you're going to have a lot of difficulty closing. You can have some of these patients that have just a horrendous-looking CT scan, and yet it's relatively easy to fix their hernias. And by the same token, you can have some that don't look so bad, and you can't get the viscera back into the abdomen. Synonyms for giant ventral hernia: large, massive, huge, complex. Sometimes the whole visceral compartment, including the kidneys, are in the hernia sac. Well, what is a giant ventral hernia? Since we can't define it, you'll know one when you see one. This certainly qualifies as a giant ventral hernia, and I don't think there's too many people that's going to try to tackle this one. Certainly I wouldn't. But this is more characteristic of what we see. Burst abdomen is a problem that we have to deal with these in the same vein as the giant ventral hernias. We face this problem of loss of domain, as you can see in this CT scan, with much of the viscera outside the abdominal cavity. Loss of domain has causes a significant number of problems. it decreases the abdominal wall elasticity, and this is primarily because of disuse. The abdominal muscles aren't used as much because the viscera aren't there. The muscles atrophy because they have nothing to contain. This reduces the size due to disuse, atrophy. The ventilation is interfered with. Diaphragms come down, making it more difficult to replace the viscera. And there is impaired venous and lymphatic return from longstanding hernias because the intestines become thickened and decreases the lymphatic return. And then we have to deal with the problem with the abdominal compartment syndrome when we repair these syndromes. And when we repair these hernias, because there's so much interabdominal contents that have to be replaced. Commonly associated conditions with these giant hernias, overlying skin ulceration. This is a typical patient here with multiple ulcers over the hernia sac, probably ischemic in nature. They have persistent infection, commonly have intracutaneous fistulas, diverting stomas, morbid obesity is the rule, and a history of multiple repairs. That's the typical patient we see with these kind of hernias. The clinical presentation is an incapacitating, a huge pannus, unsightful, painful, restricts the patient's mobility. They commonly have back problems. Their respiratory function is altered and a dramatic effect on their quality of life. This is a typical patient with a giant hernia. You can see the pannus hanging down below the knee, severely limits his life. These hernias are almost never reproducible because of loss of domain. They can present with bowel obstruction because they can have a narrow neck, but more commonly they have sort of multiple Swiss cheese loculations in the hernia itself, and an isolated loop of bowel becomes obstructed. One of the peculiar phenomenons in these patients with these giant hernias is that they can have serious pathology in the hernia sac itself and not really look that ill. They can have a bowel obstruction with gangrene and not really look that ill, presumably because the hernia itself sort of isolates the process from the systemic circulation. Now, this is a patient that I have in the hospital right now who was treated for 1 month for quote, diverticulitis because she's febrile and pain in the hernia and the colon was in the hernia, as you'll see on the CT scan, but then was sent to us with this ischemia and draining feces. And when we explored her, she had a ruptured appendix. Her problem was a ruptured appendix, as you can see there, with a fecal lift right at the base. So she smoldered along for a whole month with a ruptured appendix, walking around, eating. But once we did the surgery, the patient became critically ill and went into renal failure, on the ventilator for days, only now is starting to recover. So this is a peculiar phenomenon characteristic of these giant hernias. Preoperative workup, computed tomography is essential in all of these patients preoperatively. We need to know the status of the abdominal muscles so we know what we have to work with. We need to know the defect size, the volume, and we have to exclude any other pathologies. Now, you can't have a program to take care of these giant hernias without a bariatric arm. Because these patients are almost always morbidly obese, the chance of successful repair is inversely proportional to their BMI. A BMI less than 30 is ideal, but rarely can be achieved. But there's a big problem with this. Commonly, the bariatric arm is not available, and that's because if the patient's symptoms are so bad, they can't wait for that. They might have signs of impending obstruction, and then you have insurance problems. Many insurance companies exclude it or insist on a minimum of 1 year supervised weight loss before they'll approve it. So from a practical standpoint, it's difficult to use bariatrics, but whenever we can, we do, and it does help a lot. Preoperative workup, we've got to control abdominal wall sepsis, drain any abscesses, remove any infected material, debride in as much as necessary to have clean tissue, topical ointments for specific organisms such as staph, yeast, or cornobacterium are appropriate. Now, these are extensive operations in these huge patients, so we have to have these people prepared properly for their cardiorespiratory problems. we have to be prepared for a pulmonary embolism and appropriately treat them. Anticipate a prolonged anesthesia, anticipate massive shifts of fluid, which will continue well into the postoperative period, and then be prepared for renal failure, intra-abdominal hypertension, and wound-related complications. At a minimum, pulmonary function studies are essential in all these patients. Stress tests for cardiac conditions are important. The role of vena cava filters is debatable. There is some evidence that in very obese patients that the filter actually slows the blood flow and predisposes to deep DVT in the legs. So it's quite controversial whether filters are indicated. Here's a problem we face all the time with these patients. Despite the fact that they have very severe, overwhelming risks, they are so miserable with their condition that they're willing to accept a substantial chance of mortality rather than have to live with their hernia. This is a problem I face on a weekly basis for sure. Well, let's go on to operative management, conventional versus laparoscopic. Really, that laparoscopy has no role other than as an adjuvant in these patients. We'll sometimes use it to make sure that we can't fix the hernia laparoscopically, but when we see a huge separation of the rectus muscles, as you see on this video, we know that there's no way that this can be repaired laparoscopically with any hope for any decent success. And this is the reason why. You see, here is a patient that has a very nicely repaired hernia, but the muscles aren't together. The rectus muscles are separated, and so here goes the prosthesis ballooning out through the defect. Now, technically, the patient doesn't have a recurrence. Technically, this is just stretching of the mesh, but this patient is not very happy with what she sees from the outside. So we do use laparoscopy as an adjuvant sometimes also to look at the end to make sure we haven't included any intra-abdominal viscera in our closure of the fascia, because this sometimes it's so tight it's very difficult to keep from doing that, and sometimes we'll leave one of these balloon 5-millimeter cannulas and then take a look at the end of the 5-millimeter scope just to make sure we haven't damaged any bowel. Prosthetic materials, you can't talk about reconstructing these abdominal walls without saying something about prosthetic materials. The ideal characteristics were defined by Cumberland many years ago: strong, pliable, durable, hypoallergenic, non-carcinogenic, easily sterilizable, resistant to infection, no foreign body reaction, minimal adhesions, and transparent, which is especially important in laparoscopic surgery. Well, what do we do? We've got all these products out in the market. How do you make sense of what you're supposed to use in what situation? Well, I just have some general rules that I use, and I'll just briefly go through them with you. Polyester versus polypropylene, I don't think it makes any difference. Dealer's choice. They tend to use polyester in Europe. We tend to use polypropylene here in the States. There probably really isn't any difference. There was a time when we felt that polyester was not resistant to infection, but I don't think anybody really thinks that anymore. Heavyweight versus lightweight. Clearly, the lightweight meshes result in less chronic postoperative pain and better abdominal wall functionality. But we are seeing increasing case reports and scattered reports of burst mesh. In other words, hernias right through the center of the lightweight mesh. So I think we need to be aware, especially in very, very heavy patients, that using these lightweight meshes. Non-coated versus microporous versus coated meshes. This is kind of where the wheel goes around in this whole area. Let's talk about mesh versus membrane first. By definition, a mesh has grossly visible interstices, which allow the ingrowth of scar tissue. And this process incites a dense fibroblastic tissue response, which results in ingrowth and a strong mesh epidermolytic interface. And for this reason, because it heals by incorporation like this, it has the possibility of eroding into bowel and therefore is not acceptable as an agent to be in contact with intra-abdominal viscera. And this is just a picture of a patient with a mesh that's eroded into a small intestine. Now, mesh versus membrane. Expanded PTFE or Gore-Tex is commonly referred to as a mesh, but it isn't. It actually acts more like a membrane. Its pores cannot be seen, so you can't call it a mesh. They can only be seen microscopically. They're so small that there's minimal tissue ingrowth, although not so small that they prevent bacterial infiltration. Bacteria have no problem, which is one of the problems with Gore-Tex. This is a picture that probably all of you are familiar with. It's in every textbook showing the nodal arrangement of Gore-Tex. So mesh versus membrane, the membrane thwarts the acute inflammatory response because of the lack of macropores. So there's minimal infiltration, and the process heals by encapsulation rather than incorporation. And that's why it does not have the tendency to erode into bowel and why it's safe to put it in contact with bowel. It's considered the gold standard for intraperitoneal placement because of this phenomenon. But it's not a perfect material by any means. It shrinks considerably, and then it cannot stand up to infection. If it gets infected, it will have to be removed. It's almost never salvageable. Now, membrane versus the coated meshes. Well, we have a whole variety of coated meshes now, coated with adhesion barrier products. And the purpose of this was to try to come up with an alternative to EPTFE. So have something that you could put a coat onto polypropylene and have it not have the tendency to erode into bowel. The coating, of course, is applied on the side that faces the viscera, and the polypropylene side is on the abdominal wall side. Well, neither EPTFE or the coated meshes prevent adhesions completely, and anybody that's re-explored patients, which probably everybody in this room have, know that there's dense, difficult adhesions in all of these adhesion barrier products, and Gore-Tex for that matter. The thing about Gore-Tex, though, is it does have a long history, and its cases of erosion into bowel with Gore-Tex are almost reportable because it's so rare, and it remains to be seen whether the coated meshes will have that same safety record. The synthetic versus biological. The biological meshes are meshes that are derived from organic material, human, porcine, or fetal, bovine, skin, and some other materials. They're processed to remove all the antigens, the hair, and everything, leaving only a tissue scaffolding with a matrix around it. The theory is that they will be infiltrated by normal cells from the host and remodeled into normal tissue. It is theoretically very good, should cause less pain, but all of these claims remain unproven. They're expensive, so it's difficult to justify using them routinely. We know the recurrence rate is unacceptable when they're used as an inlay. They just don't work as an inlay. They may be most useful in contaminated fields, and that's why they do have a role in these giant hernias, because they're so often contaminated. But the enthusiasm seems to be waning for these products because of results. The results are really not very good. Okay, this is my case for Monday when I get back. This is a patient with a huge ventral hernia with skin ulceration, MRSA growing in these wounds, which can't be eradicated, but something has to be done for the patient. She's completely incapacitated. Here's her CT scan. You can see the liver, even the gallbladder is out in the hernia sac. So if anybody has any suggestions of what I'm supposed to do with this patient, please let me know at the break. But anyway, what I've done is you might notice that there's a catheter up here in her substernal area. That's an ordinary vascular porticats, which we placed for pneumoperitoneum. And we've been over the last month progressively using pneumoperitoneum, a technique which I like. Many people don't, but I like it. The main value is the raising the diaphragms. I think it gives you a lot of extra room. Obviously, a lot of this air is going into the hernia sac, but when you see an X-ray like this when you're using pneumoperitoneum, I think you're making some headway. And so the way we do it is we put the catheter in surgery, just an ordinary vascular porticath, but instead of putting it in the vein, we put it in the abdomen. Then we keep the patient in the hospital a couple of days and start progressively blowing the thing up. We use a little eye filter there. You can see that little eye filter that we hook to the end of the catheter. And if the patient tolerates it, we send them home and have their family do it. And we see them once a week and check X-rays to make sure the diaphragms are coming up. And with that, we've had pretty good success. So I showed that slide before, the mess of all the prosthetic materials. What do we do about this? Well, the way I think about it is I break up these prostheses into these categories: non-composite heavyweight plastic, like polypropylene, pure polypropylene, non-composite heavyweight membrane, like pure Gore-Tex, non-composite lightweight plastic, which would be like UltraPro, and the non-composite heavyweight membrane, and there's a variety of lightweight Gore-Tex prostheses out there. Then you have the composite prostheses, which is a combination of Gore-Tex and polypropylene. Then you have the coated prostheses, which we've already talked about. We have the absorbable prostheses, which really don't have much place in the kind of patients I take care of on the short-term basis. That is like Vicryl, like we saw this morning in the trauma patients. It doesn't really have much place in what I do because Vicryl will not work long-term. Recurrence is inevitable. Now, the long-term prosthetics, the new class of meshes derived from E. coli, the main one comes to mind is Phasix, remain to be seen how they're going to perform. That might be a good option for patients like the one that I had showed earlier that I've got to operate on Monday. And then the biologics we've already talked about. Okay, operative management. We really have three choices of what we're going to do on an open basis. We're going to do an overlay, inlay, or underlay. Now, the inlay we know works very poorly. It works poorly with biologics, but it also works poorly with synthetic meshes. And it's probably the last choice. But sometimes there really is no choice. You got a big burst abdomen like this with a skin graft, but all you can do is take the skin graft off and use an inlay. Get the skin closed and then hope that you'll get a little bit of medialization of the muscles because you've got the skin graft off and the skin back intact, and maybe you can come back and fight another day if you have a recurrence. But we try to avoid that because it doesn't work very well. Overlay, popular in many units. Most of the onlay techniques use some form of a combination of what I'm going to show now. They're combined fascia and onlay mesh. So the fascia is opened circumferentially around the defect. It's then rotated medially and closed in the midline to isolate the viscera, and then the onlay is placed over the top of that and sewn to the cut edge of where you entered the rectus sheath to make your original rotation, as shown in cartoon three. Now, the classic Scheffel procedure is a little bit more extensive. It's similar in how the anterior rectus sheath is rotated medially and approximated in the midline, but the mesh is placed much further lateral, all the way to the lateral side of the rectus emblem. Now, the underlay technique, I think, no question, this is the gold standard operation for repairing these large hernias, or maybe even moderate-sized ventral hernias. And it's a very nice operation. The anterior rectus sheath is opened, or the posterior rectus sheath is opened. You can do it either way, as long as you get into the rectus envelope and rotate the sheath medially. Then develop your space beneath the rectus muscle all the way to the lateral edge of the rectus envelope, and then use some type of suture passer device to pass sutures, which are attached to a piece of polypropylene or whatever prosthetic material you want to use, pull it all the way to the lateral edge of the rectus envelope beneath the rectus muscle, and then ideally the rectus muscles are reapproximated over that in the midline. A very good operation. It requires the use of some device like this. The top is what's called an OWL suture passer. It's an ENT instrument. Works very well in our hands for passing sutures out the lateral side of the rectus envelope. But you can also use a exit closure device, a laparoscopic exit closure device, if you prefer. And this is just the utility technique that we all use to close trocar sites, but it's a modification of this that we used when we use the exit devices. Just a few pictures of the rectus rectus. Here we are, and we've developed our space beneath the rectus muscle. Here, we have sutures tied to the lateral edge of a piece of lightweight mesh. then these sutures are pulled out through these, with the OWL suture passer, out through these stab incisions. Very important to get rid of those dimples. If you don't get rid of those dimples, they'll be perfect. And then they have to do with gathering up of subcutaneous tissue when you tie the knots. And then you have, this is the end result. And then the rectus muscles are reapproximated over the top. Invariably, when you do these procedures, you have to resect skin because it's going to be redundant. Now, component separation, non-prosthetic. Here I'm showing the classic Ramirez technique, the first of the component separations where the, and we saw that earlier today, where the external oblique is open just lateral to the rectus envelope, allowing us to advance the mesh, the muscles medially and close primarily. Now, when the general surgeon started doing this procedure, they were so used to using prosthetic material, it was pretty quick that they combined prosthetic materials with this procedure, and that's what most people are doing today. So basically what you do is the same operation you do as you would a rectus procedure, but in addition to that, you do the external oblique release, and that affords you tension-free closure of both the posterior rectus sheath and the reapproximation of the rectus muscles in the midline. Popular among many now is the sandwich technique, where you do the same thing, except here we're showing posterior rectus sheath, anterior rectus sheath closed after over, above the mesh, and then a second piece of mesh is placed on top of that. And the purpose of that is to secure it from the cut edge of the external oblique aponeurosis laterally, because we're seeing increasing reports of hernias through the component separation site. So by securing the a second prosthesis, especially lightweight mesh like this, one can eliminate that problem. So it's to the lateral cut edge of the external, not the medial. Now, the new player on the block, and the one that I think is going to have a lot of utility in the future, is the transversus abdominis release, or the posterior component separation. Now, the principle here is that, you know, the transversus abdominis muscle actually inserts not at the edge, as is shown in most anatomic and anatomy books, but actually inserts a little bit more medial on the posterior rectus sheath. So it's possible to get into this space right here and divide the transversus abdominis muscle here and then develop this plane right here beneath the between the transversus abdominis and the transversalis fascia and peritoneum. And this will allow you to get all the way to the psoas muscle without any problem if you get into the right plane. Now we talked, this is what was, a, oops, this, when Dr. Croce talked this morning, I was very concerned because this is where the nerves come from, the intercostals between the transversus and the internal oblique, and they would seem to be with the procedure he was describing to be at very significant risk. But I'm gonna talk to him later on, because I really didn't understand that operation, so I'm gonna have to talk to him later on, have him explain it to me better. But anyway, so what's done is the transversus abdominis muscle is divided, and it's not easy to do this because the peritoneum and transversalis fascia is extremely thin. What you have to do is take a right angle clamp, just barely pick up the transversus abdominis muscle, and then divide it away from the peritoneum. So it takes a little practice to learn how to do this. If you start in the upper abdomen, it's much easier and work your way down. But you can get all the way into the space of rectus, so you can. This procedure is good from the diaphragm to the space of rectus. So here you can see the division of the transversus abdominis muscle here. There's the cut edge, there, and that's the peritoneum and transversalis fascia there. Now this is a video of a patient with a large hernia, wide separation of the rectus muscles. You can see what we're dealing with here, and we're going to have trouble getting all this viscera back into the abdominal cavity without rather extensive mobilization and of the elements of the abdominal wall. And this technique works very well. You can see there's the cut edge of the transverse abdominis muscle, this very thin transversalis fascia here. But just look how far you can get, though. You can go all the way to the psoas muscle because you can just continue your dissection. In fact, I worry sometimes about getting the ureters with this operation. I haven't seen it reported anywhere, but it allows for such a wide dissection. So here we are positioning the mesh just above the psoas muscle. It's the same technique we use for the retrorectus. We attach long absorbable sutures to the mesh and then use our owl suture passer and bring it out through the mid-axillary line and pull the mesh all the way to the psoas muscle. Commonly, We'll use bone anchors to the and drill holes into the anterior spiroiliac spine and use those to further anchor, especially if there's been things like tram flaps done where there's very little muscle. But it's the same principle. You can get to the anterior spiroiliac spine, no problem. It's right there with this technique. So just showing how far we have this down. Okay. Now there's some adjuvant strategies. I know we're a little out of time, but I only have about 5 minutes. Okay. Who's running the show? Just some adjuvant strategies that we use for these patients, because sometimes, no matter with all the techniques I've described here today, that's not possible to solve these problems. So pneumoperitoneum, I've already talked a little bit about. This is the classic Goni-Marino technique, and ours is a modification of that. Here's a patient with a huge ventral hernia, which we didn't think we could repair any other way. Here's our catheter in place. Remember, it's an ordinary vascular catheter. And progressive pneumoperitoneum for a month, as I've already described. Medialization is a technique which I have a little bit of familiarity with. It's popular in some circles. It's just a technique of suturing, usually Gore-Tex, to the cut edge of a abdominal wall that you can't get closed, and then bringing the patient back to the OR every few days and taking out a strip of it and then reapproximating, trying to medialize the abdominal wall. Works in some patients. You get smaller and smaller until you can take it out and close primarily. Resection of interabdominal viscera, this is something we all hate to do, but sometimes there's no other solution. This is a patient I showed earlier. When we tried to resect this, there was just no way we could get the viscera back, so we had to do a subtotal colectomy. That was the only solution we had. Most of the patients tolerate it pretty well. If they're above the age of 60, it can be problematic, but if they're below the age of 60, they usually tolerate it pretty well. Here's this gentleman. With that huge hernia after we did this. Tissue expanders, popular in some certain centers. I don't have too much experience with them. As was mentioned earlier today, we rarely have problems with skin. And these are showing skin tissue expanders. What we need is subfascial tissue expanders, and they can be used, but I find them to be extremely painful for patients. You try to expand the subfascial space with tissue expanders, and they have a lot of pain. So I don't know how much use they're going to be in the long run. Pedicle flaps. We have a whole list of pedicle flaps, and because we're running a little late, I'm not going to go over all of them. But the location of the abdomen is such that many of the flaps just aren't very helpful. They're not either not big enough or they're just not in the right location. But occasionally, they can be helpful. Probably free flaps are more helpful, though, in this day and age. So you can get the tissue exactly where you need it. Negative pressure wound therapy, we've heard something about that already, can be useful when you can't get the abdominal wall closed at all. Abdominal wall transplantation has been described. There's been probably a half a dozen cases in the literature now, but I have no personal experience with that. So in conclusion, repair of giant ventral hernias is technically challenging. The morbidity and mortality is high. Preoperative medical optimization is paramount. Directo mesh repair is the gold standard operation. Adding component separation is increasingly popular. And then we have to keep adjuvant strategies in mind. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll go to break now, and we're going to truncate break a little bit, and we start here at 3:05. So take a 10-minute break. Remember to hand in your questions.